3FM, on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news from Vaughan Savage.
The Libyan leader, Colonel Gaddafi, has called for negotiations to bring an end to NATO airstrikes, but he's refused to hand over power. In a lengthy televised address in the early hours of this morning, he said Libya was ready to enter into a ceasefire, saying that the gate to peace was open. However, he rejected a key demand of both the rebels and many of the countries involved in military action in Libya to step down as leader. Funerals are expected to be held across Syria for the people killed during anti-government demonstrations yesterday. Human rights campaigners say more than 60 protesters died in demonstrations across the country during what was labelled by the opposition as a day of rage. Overnight television viewing figures suggest nearly 25 million people in Britain watched yesterday's royal wedding. This morning, the new Duke and Duchess of Cambridge left Buckingham Palace by helicopter to begin married life together. The destination for their honeymoon hasn't been revealed. Two people have died and more than 50 others have been injured in a crash on the M11 motorway near Stansted Airport in Essex. The collision happened between a coach and a lorry in the early hours of this morning. The Taliban has announced it will begin its spring military offensive against coalition forces in Afghanistan tomorrow. In a statement, it said it would launch attacks on military bases, convoys and Afghan officials. Insurance companies in the United States say the tornadoes that swept across the south of the country this week could cost them up to $5 billion. The region's worst storms in 80 years have claimed more than 300 lives, most of them in the state of Alabama. The president of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, has arrived in Rome to celebrate the beatification of Pope John Paul II tomorrow. A European Union travel ban means Mr. Mugabe cannot visit member states, but Vatican City is exempt from the rule because it is deemed a sovereign state. The weather, most places will have a dry, warm and sunny afternoon, although there'll be a brisk easterly wind. The BBC News and Weather at 2 minutes past one.
And now the Early Music Show. The programme was recorded a few weeks ago when Catherine Bott's guest, James O'Donnell, was heavily involved with the arrangements for yesterday's royal wedding.
Thank you. A motet, possibly by Philippe de Vitry, performed on that CD by Diabolus in Musica, directed by Antoine Gerber, but originally sung at the wedding of Philippa of Hainault and the 15-year-old Edward III, recently crowned King of England, on the 13th of June 1328. The manuscript was a gift to themselves and each other by the bride and groom. Well, that sets the tone for today's celebratory royal wedding edition of the Early Music Show, with the necessary something old. I wonder how far I can take that wedding list, and yes, I know it's usually applied just to bridal wear. Helping with the pre-wedding nerves today, I'm delighted to welcome James O'Donnell, organist and Master of the Choristers of Westminster Abbey, who, as we speak, is fairly steeped in advance preparations for a certain big day. Welcome, James. Can you tell me, what musical requirements, if any, are there for a wedding? Not just a royal wedding, any wedding in a church.
Well, I think, strictly speaking, there are no musical requirements for a wedding. The only requirement you need for a marriage to be celebrated is the bride and groom to be present and two witnesses. And they simply need to exchange vows. This needs to be recorded, and that's it. So the essentials of a wedding service are extremely simple, if you look at it very theoretically. But, of course, they are public occasions and the celebratory occasions, and I think the more significant the participants, let's say, then the bigger the occasion, and the more public interest it takes on, the larger scale it has, and it could be broadcast and have lots of grand music, and so the possibilities are rather endless, and they're entirely conformed to the wishes of the couple and the circumstances and the occasion.
A lot of our royal weddings have in fact not been in the grand places like St Paul's Cathedral and Westminster Abbey that we associate with all these things. I mean, the Chapel Royal, which is a much smaller venue, has been the scene of many a king or queen, from Hanoverians, and Queen Victoria was married there. There's not much room to have very grand music in venues like that. But if you've got Westminster Abbey, presumably the world is your oyster for grand anthems.
Well, I think obviously the space available gives you more possibilities in all kinds of areas, ceremonially as well as musically. But I think that the attitude towards the place of a wedding in royal ceremonial has probably evolved over the centuries. In early days, it would have been a fairly private occasion, I think, and regarded as something for the family and not of big media interest, because there wasn't a sort of equivalent of today's media to be interested in it. This current wedding is going to be the 16th royal wedding, we think, in the history of Westminster Abbey. So if you think of how many royal weddings there have been in the last, I don't know, 900 years, that's not very many to have taken place in this building.
Well, it's been a tantalising research project, this programme, because actually royal wedding music of the past isn't very well documented. For example, it's known that three members of the Ferrabosco family played at the wedding of Mary, Queen of Scots, to the Dauphin of France in 1558. So one just longs to know what the wedding playlist was in 1558. Still, we do have some majestic music to listen to, and we're moving on to the Hanoverians, part of an anthem by Handel for the marriage of George II's son, Prince Frederick, to Princess Augusta of Saxe-Coburg in 1736. This is Sing Unto God.
Thank you.
James Bowman, the Choir of New College Oxford and the King's Consort, directed by Robert King, with part of an anthem by Handel, first heard, possibly, at a royal wedding in 1736 in the Chapel Royal St James's. Let's continue with Handel. He's so popular, I've been discovering in my researches, with European royalty today, especially the Hallelujah Chorus to come out to. Why do they all like him so much? What is it about Handel and royal occasions?
Well, I think Handel made a point of positioning himself in his working life as the court composer of choice. I mean, he deliberately cultivated and developed his own style of grand ceremonial music. And he perfected this style, which was at once attractive and accessible, but also incredibly dignified and had grandeur without being pompous. And I think that's the thing. It just stops short of being pompous music. It's got that joie de vivre below the sense of ceremonial dignity. And I think this is why people go for him.
Well, that was a bit tough, really, I'm thinking, on some of his contemporaries or near contemporaries. I mean, there were some perfectly good native composers who slightly got sidelined. The next piece of music we're going to hear is one that was written for another Hanoverian king, George III, who married Princess Charlotte Sophia of Mecklenburg-Strelitz, again in the Chapel Royal, on the 8th of September of 1761. It's the only surviving example of John Stanley's theatre music from his pastoral entitled Arcadia or the Shepherd's Wedding.
Raise with sand on sin his cheer.
Music by John Stanley for George III's wedding, performed by baritone Andrew Knight and the Parley of Instruments, directed by Roy Goodman. With me in the studio is James O'Donnell from Westminster Abbey. James, that Stanley piece, The Shepherd's Wedding, seems to be attempting to shoehorn the peasantry into the rejoicing. But what about the symbolic purpose of royal wedding music? Is it supposed to involve the whole nation?
Well, I think that's inevitable, really, and particularly of late, when these ceremonies have both attracted so much interest within the nation itself and also internationally. But I think that people generally are incredibly interested in these events, and they very much identify with the participants, and there's a natural feeling of celebration and of goodwill and of joining in.
There does seem always at the time of royal weddings to be this upsurge of goodwill and joviality, which is good for everyone's morale.
I think that is true. And I think in any wedding that one attends as a guest, I mean, married people who go to weddings cannot but be reminded of their own marriages. And this is, I think, writ large for all royal weddings. They inspire a lot of goodwill and lots of very good memories and generally are occasions for stopping and thinking about the good things in life and wonderful things. Love, marriage, being together, happiness, and putting aside the kind of ghastly things that go on around us all the time.
Well, as director of things at Westminster Abbey, you're responsible for helping to choose music for many important ceremonial events.
Yes.
Does this feel like a huge responsibility?
It is a huge responsibility. It's also a very inspiring responsibility because, actually, the longer I've been at Westminster Abbey, the more I have come to appreciate that occasions that take place there are often putting down markers in our national life. And to have the opportunity to help express that and to try to find, you know, exactly the right music or exactly the right musical expression of the purpose and intent of any occasion can be very challenging, but also it's something that one feels one has to rise to. Of course, weddings are absolutely part of that, but there are many, many services where one has to think very, very carefully, you know, what is the piece? We have maybe 10 pieces that could do. Which is the one that we can actually do and which will really make its mark and really encapsulate what we are trying to do? That's a very interesting thing to be involved in.
Well, going back to the Tudors for a moment, and there is method in my madness here. When Mary Tudor married Philip of Spain in Winchester Cathedral in 1554, the Spanish composer Cristobal Morales was appointed to oversee the wedding music, but he died a few weeks beforehand. So his countryman Antonio de Capizón took over. His choice of music isn't documented, or at any rate not available on CD. So with a bit of lateral thinking, I'm taking us on to the something new category in my wedding list. Mary Tudor, Mary Queen of Scots, they both took foreign royal husbands for largely political reasons. All those Hanoverian princes made dynastic marriages, necessary and fully understood by all. And King George III's marriage to his German princess was a long and happy one, despite many troubles. But nowadays, our handsome European princes marry for love. In 2004, Felipe of Spain, Príncipe de Asturias, the Spanish equivalent of our Prince of Wales, married the gorgeous Leticia Ortiz Rocasolano, who was not only a commoner, but also, gasp, a television journalist and presenter, and divorced. Their wedding mass was crammed with wonderful early music. You can read the order of service on the Spanish royal family's website, including organ music by Capizón, just the sort of music that may well have been played at the wedding of Mary Tudor and a much earlier Philip of Spain. Silas Standage played Cabezón's Diferencias sobre la Dama le Demanda, variations on a popular Spanish number of the day, The Song of the Demanding Woman. Now, I can't prove that the cathedral organist played precisely that piece as the guests arrived at the Spanish royal wedding in 2004. He's only listed, our Spanish organist, as interpreting pieces by the most notable composers of the 16th and 17th centuries. That means Cabezón and his peers. But the rest of the service is clearly documented, as you'll hear in a minute. James, this is our something new wedding, full of profound and glorious music from the golden century of Spain, works by Handel and Bach, a proper mass, which was also very sensitive back in 2004 to recent terrorist outrages in Madrid. So it ended up being slightly more low-key, I believe, than it was originally planned. What about the role of national pride? We've talked about the symbolism of the music, but this was designed, apart from the Handel and Bach, this wedding, to show what glorious music Spanish people wrote. Is there a pressure for big ceremonial occasions to stick to English stuff?
No, I don't think so, although I think when one has an occasion of a certain national significance, then obviously there's a natural desire to put one's national best foot forward. But I think hearing about the Spanish wedding in 2004, my reaction is that the couple probably had a particular enthusiasm for this kind of music. It could be regarded as rather recherche for a big occasion to concentrate on early music, and so it seems to me that perhaps they had a particular liking for it and said, well, we would like this at our wedding, and it so happens also to encapsulate something great about Spanish music as well. I mean, it sounds very interesting. I wish I'd been there. I wish I'd heard the service. It's extraordinary.
It was quite a thing. I saw it on Spanish television, and it was a glorious and beautiful wedding. And as the bride's parents arrived, they heard a movement from an organ concerto by Handel.
Thank you.
Tom Copeman playing the Allegro from Handel's Organ Concerto in B-flat. Well, I do hope you've all got your posh hats on. This is a special royal wedding edition of the Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott, and with me in the studio is James O'Donnell, organist of Westminster Abbey. Now that, James, proved the importance of instrumental music. Again, checking modern royal weddings, I noticed that trumpet voluntaries are very popular, and they're popular with anybody's wedding these days. What is it about the use of instrumental music?
I think in the case of trumpet voluntaries, they're very popular at all kinds of weddings. But the genre of trumpet voluntary, I think I'm correct in saying, doesn't actually relate to the trumpet that we're talking about. It relates to the trumpet stop on an organ, because the trumpet voluntary was simply a voluntary for organ which used the trumpet stop. And arrangements of these organ pieces have been made, and they encapsulate the brilliance and the joie de vivre of the occasion very well, I think.
Well, staying with the happy coincidence of the marriage in 2004 of Prince Felipe of Spain to Letizia, here's some music from their wedding mass. And when we've heard it, I want to talk to you, James, about the difference between the Catholic wedding nuptial mass and the Anglican kind of wedding. This is music from the Missa Pro Victoria by Thomas Luis de Vitoria. The Sanctus and Benedictus from the Missa Pro Victoria by Thomas Luis de Victoria, whose death in 1611 will be commemorated in the Early Music Show later this year. The performers were the 16, conducted by Harry Christophers. Now, James, that wedding in Spain in 2004 was, of course, in a Catholic country. It was observant of all Catholic wedding rites, and it was a proper nuptial mass. The Anglican wedding is not structured in the same way. What is the big difference?
Again, the essentials of a marriage service are there whether one has a nuptial mass or not. So the nuptial mass is elective. And so the difference simply is that with a nuptial mass, there is a whole celebration of the Eucharist into which the celebration of the marriage is placed. That, of course, musically means that if you have a choir there, you can have a choral setting of the ordinary of the Mass and the various proper chants as well. So it becomes, in a way, much more like a normal celebration of the liturgy, but with the special character of a marriage included within it.
In most ordinary weddings with 100 or 50 guests or whatever, most of the music has a different dimension. It isn't just music, it's music during which things happen. The bride comes in and it's the first sight of the dress, and people walk in and out and people say things and do things, and there's lots to look at for your average wedding goer. And then there is a moment during every church wedding when the couple and their witnesses must sign the register, and they usually disappear somewhere to do this. We don't see this being done quite often, but it's a chance to just sit and contemplate a beautiful piece of music.
Mm-hmm.
Would you always recommend for any wedding something contemplative and uplifting for this moment?
I think that the field is wide open. You can have something very, very grand and something quite extended, or you could have a number of shorter pieces. You can have something contemplative, you can have something jolly. I think it really depends on your taste and how you see that moment. Sometimes the signing of the register takes place in the middle of the service, and then the couple emerge, and then the rest of the nuptial mass takes place afterwards. So you might want your music to do a different job there. So the context can vary according to the rite one is following.
Well, the Spanish wedding couple approved of the choice of Bach's Cantata 69 for this moment. Here's the opening chorus. Bless thou the Lord, O my spirit, and forget not the good things he has given thee. the Amsterdam Baroque Orchestra and Choir conducted by Ton Koopman in the opening of Bach's cantata Lobe den Herrn meine Seele. We've really dwelt on the well-documented wedding of Felipe and Letizia in Spain, grateful for the Spanish Royal Family website, but that's partly because researching this programme, the music at royal weddings is poorly documented. I mentioned this, but why isn't anybody interested in writing down what happened? Or is it just that nothing much did happen?
I think a lot did happen, but I don't think until fairly recently it occurred to people to document the music. It's well known that a lot of our knowledge about how the music went at, for example, some coronations in the 18th century was basically left to us by accountants who wrote down how many violinists were paid and trust the accountants to sort of help us out with their fastidious documentation. But I think that the concept, for example, of a service paper is a relatively recent one, and until probably the 19th century, the congregation at big services might well have received some kind of ceremonial list and a processional orders and things like that, but the music would have received scant notice. It simply wouldn't have been something that would have been documented in great detail.
Well, let's return to mid-18th century England, to the Chapel Royal and George III's wedding, which gives us our something borrowed. The weddings of the three children of George II were all celebrated with elaborate ceremonies, the first of their kind to have such grandeur since the big Tudor weddings 200 years earlier. For this one, William Boyce, composer of the Chapel Royal, was obliged to put aside his new work for the impending coronation and dash off a wedding anthem. He complained to the Archbishop of Canterbury that this task would increase his difficulties, and after a certain amount of to-ing and fro-ing, the Archbishop accepted Boyce's practical stratagem, which was to borrow a section from his already completed coronation anthem and insert it into a wedding anthem of the same name. That name is important. The King Shall Rejoice. It emphasises the fact that it's not just some prince that's getting married, but a reigning king. And George was indeed crowned 2 weeks later. Boyce's wedding anthem included 122 bars from the coronation anthem. And as it's the latter that's been recorded for our delight, that's what we'll hear now. The performers are the Choir of New College, Oxford, and the Academy of Ancient Music, conducted by Edward Higginbottom.
Thank you.
William Boyce's coronation anthem for George III, The King Shall Rejoice, a section of which had been borrowed by Boyce himself for use in the King's wedding anthem. Last year, the Crown Princess of Sweden was married, and she enjoyed, during the service, a song specially co-written by Benny of ABBA, which combines national pride, domestic felicity, and all-round joyfulness, really. I think it's a marvellous idea. Now, James, is there generally a greater open-mindedness, do you think, about these things? Or is there just more music available to have at royal weddings?
Well, I think it's actually the seizing of a really great opportunity, because not everybody gets the chance to have music specially written for their wedding. But for a royal wedding and the amount of interest and the importance placed on the music, I think that it's an obvious opportunity to create some new music if one can. It seems to me particularly appropriate when one is at the start of a new adventure in life to accompany that with a new adventure musically. And so I see a big parallel there.
Now, in early music terms, we've had something old, something new, and something borrowed in the programme, but I have to admit to getting a bit stuck with the quest for something blue. But here's an early 17th century find, the nearest I think we should go with that concept. On February the 14th, 1613, in London, Princess Elizabeth, daughter of King James the 6th and 1st of Scotland, England and Ireland, was married. That evening, the Lord's Masque proclaimed itself as presented in the banqueting house on the marriage night of the high and mighty Count Palatine and the royally descended the Lady Elizabeth. Among the contributing musicians was Thomas Campion. Here's his song, Woo Her and Win Her.
Woo her and win her, he that can. Each woman hath two lovers. So she must take and leave a man till time more grace discovers. This doth Jove to show that want makes beauty more respected. If fair women were more scant, they would be more affected. Courtship and music suit with love, they both are works of passion. Happy is he whose words can move, yet sweet notes help persuasion. Mix your words with music then, that they the more may enter. Bolder songs are fit for men that on strange beauties vent.
David Thomas with Anthony Rooley and Trevor Jones offering encouragement to connubiality in that song by Thomas Campion. James O'Donnell, I have one more question. We're sitting here well in advance of the royal wedding. I think I'm probably allowed to ask you, are you and the choir and your organists looking forward to it?
Yes, very much. It's a wonderful privilege to have the opportunity to be involved in such an exciting thing, and we are all very excited.
Well, thank you very much for sparing the time in the run-up to the wedding to come and talk to the Early Music Show. We're going to play this festive programme out with a snippet of music from Queen Victoria's wedding to Prince Albert of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha in 1840. Naturally, I've tried to focus today on weddings that led to happy marriages, and theirs truly was one. The ceremony took place in the Chapel Royal, with a multitude of Victoria's subjects thronging outside. And outside too, no room in the chapel, a military band played Haste to the Wedding. And here it is to end with, Major T.L. Sharp conducting the regimental band of the Coldstream Guards.
Haste to the Wedding, played by the Regimental Band of the Coldstream Guards. And that ends today's Early Music Show, which was presented by Catherine Bott. She was talking to James O'Donnell, and the programme was produced by Rebecca Bean. Well, in tomorrow's programme, Catherine presents a concert performed by Musica Fiata and La Cappella Ducale, performed at last year's York Early Music Festival and featuring wedding music from the time of the Thirty Years' War. That's at the same time, just after 1 o'clock.
Sir Thomas Beecham was a major influence on British musical life. Orchestral entrepreneur, opera impresario and fearless champion of little-known composers and music. His vision, to make Britain a musical nation. In a special evening on BBC Radio 3 this Bank Holiday Monday, I'll be drawing on a wealth of Beecham's recordings, hearing from the people who knew him and discussing his achievements as we pay tribute to a great music maker and coruscating wit who died 50 years ago. Join me, Susie Klein, for an evening with Sir Thomas Beecham this Bank Holiday Monday from 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, now we have another chance to hear last Monday's lunchtime concert, which was broadcast live from Wigmore Hall here in London by the American pianist Nicholas Angelich. He opened the programme with Busoni's arrangement of Bach's chorale prelude Nun komm der Heiden Heiland.
Thank you.
Manzoni's arrangement for piano of Bach's Chorale Prelude Nun komm der Heiden Heiland, played by Nicholas Angelich. And continuing the somewhat introspective mood, the next items on the programme were the three intermezzi by Brahms, Opus 117, which are among Brahms's last works and were written with his friend Clara Schumann in mind.